Hello and welcome to a Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care CME podcast interview. My name is Guy Melrose and today's talk is with Professor Tony Attwood. Tony is an Associate Professor of Psychology at Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. He's been in clinical practice for 40 years and is a leading expert on autism and in particular Asperger's syndrome. April is Autism Awareness Month. Whilst the diagnosis and management of autism spectrum disorders is not within the scope of urgent care practice, we interact with patients on the autism spectrum all the time. Some features of ASDs can make our job more difficult, so I approached Tony to see if he were able to explain why an urgent care clinic or emergency department creates issues for those on the spectrum, what associated features might predispose them to certain illnesses or injuries, and to explain what we can do with regards to our approach to these patients to make the whole consultation easier and more productive for all involved. Tony saw great value in sharing this information with our community, so I'm extremely grateful to him for taking time out of a very busy schedule to talk with me. If you have an interest in learning more about autism, and in particular Asperger's, his book Asperger's Syndrome: A Guide for Parents and Professionals is worth a read. Now, following this talk, we will close out the podcast with a different piece of music to normal. Dan Bull is an English musician, rapper, and songwriter, whose work is available on all online platforms, with his videos available on YouTube. He is best known for his songs about video games, as well as issues relating to digital rights. But Dan is on the autism spectrum, and has recorded songs that reflect his experiences living with autism. So with his permission, we're closing the podcast with one of his songs, which I feel reflects well on the preceding discussion. You will note I've had to bleep out one swear word just to keep things family friendly. Now I would urge you all to have a listen to some of Dan's music. His wordplay and vocal skills are very impressive, and whilst video game raps might not be on your personal playlist, your kids will love his Fortnite songs. Links are in the show notes. So here's my chat with Professor Tony Attwood. So I'd like to welcome to the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care's podcast, Professor Tony Attwood. Tony is the adjunct professor at Griffith University for psychology. He's a psychologist with over 40 years of clinical training, clinical experience, sorry. He's originally from the UK, but is now based in Brisbane in Australia since about 1992, I believe. And he is a world authority on Asperger's syndrome, which is part of the autism spectrum. And Tony's kindly agreed to talk to the podcast today about how autism spectrum disorders and urgent care collide when injuries and acute illness happen to patients on the autism spectrum. I'm sure we can all remember cases where patients have been presenting with acute illness and injury who have an autism spectrum disorder, and that can cause us some issues in appropriately managing these patients. So, Tony, thank you for agreeing to talk to our podcast today. It's very kind of you.
Thank you, Guy.
I think if we start with the question, what is autism spectrum disorders? And I think that's probably the best place to start.
Okay. Technically, it's a neurodevelopmental disorder. Basically, various structures within the brain are not working as we would anticipate. But first of all, the person with autism has no dysmorphic features. They don't look any different from any child or adult that you've seen before. But one of the major problems for those with autism is the neurological structures for social reasoning, reading faces, body, aren't working as effectively as they should be. So the person finds people and social situations very difficult to read. There are also aspects of high levels of anxiety, sensory sensitivity, unusual behavior and mannerisms. But I suppose the central feature of autism is a difficulty working out what other people are thinking, feeling, and are going to do.
So if you were to then add into the mix pain or acute illness, and then have this person presenting to an emergency department or an urgent care setting, that will understandably make it difficult for the patient. And that on the flip side, it makes it difficult for us to then potentially get the information that we need from this patient to make a proper diagnosis. So it's a relatively common, or surprisingly common, the autism spectrum disorders. Is that right? There's more people out there than probably we would appreciate.
Yes, Guy, I think that the numbers are about 1 in 60. And the expression ranges from those who have severe communication and intellectual disabilities right through to university professors of medicine. And so the spectrum, as it's called, has a wide range of expressions.
And that would then make it difficult for us to maybe intuit that the person in front of us might have an autism spectrum disorder when they present to us. So what sort, if we were to talk about the sorts of associated features with an autism spectrum disorder that might make it difficult for us to examine and treat an acutely ill or injured person, which would be the first one we would start with? Would it be the sensory side of things?
Okay, indeed, Guy, I would choose the sensory. We have no idea why in autism the sensory system is modified in a particular way, usually with hypersensitivity to sensory experiences. Now, when we have someone with autism, they almost invariably have a sensitivity to certain sounds, especially sudden, sharp, clashing noises. In an accident, in emergency, you're going to get a lot of the pings and the noises going on. But it's also the lights, the light intensity that you need to see what you're doing as a doctor or nurse. But that light intensity is actually incredibly aversive to a person with autism. There's all the strange aromas, the chemicals and so on. There's people touching you because there's a tactile sensitivity. So there's going to be a sensory overload for the person that they find very difficult to cope with. But there's another dimension, and that is that we find the pain sensitivity and pain threshold for autism can go in either of two directions. Either the person doesn't seem to react to pain. We don't know if that is actually getting through to the brain that the pain is there, or whether the person has an inability to express it. But quite often the pain tolerance is extraordinary, or you get the reverse, and the slightest discomfort is going to produce a huge reaction. So you're going to get someone who has an altered sensory profile. Now, if you're in an accident emergency, what I would recommend is you need to find a sanctuary for that person. If you can, away from the noise, the bustle, the lights, etc., somewhere they can go that is relatively sensorily quiet in all its senses.
So the sound and the lighting is important. So I guess from our point of view, the triage nurse, if they identify a child or a young adult with an autism spectrum disorder, making these considerations early will be important, because if it's a busy day and the waiting room's full, having somebody sit in a busy waiting room for a long time might create more problems for this patient. So getting them through and into a place that is as desensitized as possible would be beneficial to these patients.
Now, Guy, you've just said a very important word: wait and waiting room. Those with autism don't like waiting. This is not because they've got an obnoxious personality. They genuinely find waiting, that is the vacuum, not knowing what's going to happen, not knowing how long it's going to be. Waiting is one of the key triggers for a meltdown and distress. So if at all possible, the person needs to be seen as quickly as possible. What some parents will do is actually have the child outside waiting in the car where they're comfortable and they know the car till the nurse comes out and brings them in to that environment. But waiting is a challenge.
So I guess it's important for people, maybe if particularly if they haven't identified in advance about being on the autism spectrum, the tendency to maybe react to somebody getting a bit shirty about the wait time, it might be worth considering that actually they might be on the autism spectrum, and that might their behaviour might be to do with that, and not just because they are being deliberately obnoxious. And but if we do know that they're on the spectrum, it's better to prioritise them early, because we want to avoid the meltdown and the distress that can be caused to them. Going back to the sensory thing quickly, that when you're saying that somebody has a heightened sense of pain, that is obviously relevant to us, because injuries, if somebody's fallen and they're saying they're not sore, or they don't appear to be sore on their arm, there might actually be an underlying fracture, and we're governed by what we find clinically as to whether or not we do an x-ray, for example. So we should be mindful of this heightened pain potential when examining somebody, and maybe have a lower threshold for investigating in that sort of setting.
I think what happens is the doctor has to be a vet. In other words, don't necessarily take on board what the person says. Find out what you know from the clinical evidence. So if there, shall we say, quite often you'll have an x-ray and there is a fracture, but the person doesn't seem to be responding in the same way that you would expect any other patient to respond. So use your clinical experience rather than wholly relying on what the person says.
And is there a connection between patients on the autism spectrum and certain potential, like, are they more clumsy, for example? Are they more likely to be injuring themselves in falls? Is that something that, an association that we might find?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. There is a certain mortality rate amongst those with autism. Epilepsy is one of the causes, unfortunately, and a certain proportion will have seizures. There can also be a fascination with water and the possibility of drowning. But often the person is not aware of dangers and will run away when upset, and road traffic accidents can be a problem, or climbing trees wanting to escape and then falling from trees. So epilepsy, fractures, road traffic accidents, those are the main causes of admission to accident and emergency.
And what would be the typical age that a child is diagnosed? And I'm asking this in case, just to see if there are patients who maybe haven't been formally diagnosed yet, so a parent might not be able to say that their child is autistic, but we might obviously be noticing that they're coming in with a lot of clumsy injuries and might be having some issues when being examined. So what's the typical sort of pickup point in a child's life?
Some of the characteristics are very conspicuous, and they've been picked up since birth because they're premature or various other things have occurred. So some of those children with infantile spasms, all those sorts of things, have been watched and autism is identified. So autism has emerged more or less from early infancy. But there are subtle signs that may only become apparent later on. In classic autism, with major language and communication difficulties, usually 2-3 years old. Sometimes with what we call Asperger syndrome, fluent speech, ordinary intellect, but still having major problems understanding people, that may be a primary or secondary school before that's diagnosed. But of course, we still get adults who are diagnosed for the first time because the diagnostic procedures weren't available when they were children.
And that would be, they would be included in the 1 in 60, would they? Or is there going to be this kind of tip of
the iceberg? Yes, indeed, 1 in 60. Okay. Yeah, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, is the main center for research into the incidence and prevalence of autism.
And in adults, the same sort of features in terms of the pain, the differences and the aversion to light and noise will still be a factor. It's not something that change, as people get older, do they learn to modify and adapt to these sorts of situations?
Well, Guy, that's an interesting question. It's one of the ones that I ask the people that I see. And the comment is, it remains the same throughout life. what you do is you learn to tolerate it or avoid certain situations. But once you've got it, you've got it. It doesn't necessarily disappear over time. I wish it did.
And so sensitivity and sensory sensitivity is probably the most important one to be aware of early, as you mentioned, the waiting room. And so it's certainly a priority for maybe our triage nurses to pick up on. Once we're then with the patient and we're having to take a history both from parents or caregivers or from the patient themselves, you mentioned social interaction is a problem. So a patient socialising with a doctor or at least being talking to the doctor, how will those difficulties be shown, and how can we maybe account for those when we're trying to examine a patient?
Those with autism take some time to understand people and individuals in particular. So in accident and emergency, it's full of strangers. And there's also a lot of people moving around fairly quickly, and it seems chaotic from the autistic point of view. So sometimes it's the number of people. So it's trying to get, say, one nurse, one doctor, primarily to work with the person. But also in the social aspect, there will be personal space, and find it very difficult for people that they don't know to touch parts of their body, etc. And I think it's very important that if you have a child or even an adult, that they have their parent with them to give them a sense of reassurance that things are going to be okay. But unfortunately, for those with autism, on the one hand, they're not very good at reading facial expression and body language, but can be very sensitive to attitude. And if someone is negative, dismissing that person, or irritated by them, unfortunately, they will be sensitive to negative mood in others, amplify it, and that can be quite agitating. So it's very important that the attitude is of calmness, understanding, respect, and support. Despite some of their challenging behavior, that's going to be very important.
So would you say it's important to spend more time establishing that rapport, if you like, or that before proceeding to an examination side of things? Or the longer you spend in a room, is the patient more likely to be distressed by the time that you're taking with them? Is there a sort of a balance between those two aspects?
Yes, I think the worst would be to just walk in and immediately do something, which really is going to be quite offensive to the person in so many ways. So you've got to, in a way, develop a sense of rapport before you engage with any medical procedures.
Okay. And is it a good thing? Let's take this as a child, for example, with a parent there. Is it a good thing to direct your questions to the patient themselves or to the parent? Do you think they respond better to being involved in the conversation, or would they rather be absorbing from the sides, if you like, and gain your trust from seeing you interacting with their parent more?
Well, it's a very difficult one to answer, and certain circumstances will change. But the parent is going to be their guardian, their translator, their emotional support. So it's essential that they're part of it. One of the things I would strongly recommend is that the doctor or the nurse may explain what they're going to do to the mother or father, and then the mother explains it to the child, because often with her voice and her attitude, there may be greater understanding and reassurance. So it may be appropriate to first explain the procedure to the mother or father with the child listening, and then the mother to explain it to the child.
And after that, you've mentioned not kind of creating distress. If you get the feel that somebody is becoming negative towards you, if there seems to be, for whatever reason, that this rapport can't be achieved, is it better to back off and try again later, or is it a case that maybe it's better for a different clinician to try? When would you think you should maybe back out from persisting?
Oh, that's another tricky one. Depends on the situation, but I do like the suggestion of if one person can't do it, someone else might be able to. There's just something about some people connect with autism and some don't. And you want to find someone who does connect with autism. And if they do connect, they can do anything. But for those who don't connect with autism, I'm sorry, it won't work.
So it's about being mindful, I guess, and not rushing. And that's one of the problems in a busy department, that it might be the need to rush is being put upon you by the rest of the situation. But getting that environment right, the sound and the lighting and the approach right, is going to be very beneficial to the patient in the long term. But you're saying there's a kind of a feel that some people have and some people don't. So maybe trying to establish who's the better person for that would, again, go back to the nurse at the triage, might suggest maybe this doctor should see this child. That might be a good, if you've got a person in your department who's better at dealing with these sorts of patients, that's probably a better way to address it, is before going
okay,
in.
Guy, from my 40 years experience, in accident and emergency, there is probably someone there in the staff who has a child on the spectrum. It may be a doctor, it may be a nurse, but the one career that has the highest level of autistic children is medicine. So there is quite likely to be someone there who says, ah, I've got a son or a nephew or a niece with autism. I know what to do. I speak autism. I'll do this.
Yeah, so that's a good way of maybe preempting any problems, is identifying the right person to be dealing with the patient. Unfortunately, in a smaller clinic, a rural place, that there may only be the one doctor and the one nurse on, but if you can, I guess it's better to try and find somebody appropriate for that. In terms of other social problems, particularly maybe in the older, the young adults and the like, who aren't maybe present with a parent or a guardian, what sort of issues would they have that we might have to try and get through in order to elicit the right diagnosis and get the right answers to our questions?
Oh, look, it's a tricky one, because you're dealing with language problems here, and those with autism do have language difficulties. And when dealing with someone with autism, the risk can be talking too fast and too complex a language. It's really finding out from the caregivers what sort of language they use. Listen to how the parent or the caregiver talks to the person with autism, which gives you an idea of how to adjust your own language within their issues of comprehension. So sometimes talking too fast and too complex, but we often find that when you're going to go through a procedure, it is far best to demonstrate the procedure without necessarily describing it linguistically. So it's basically, this is what I'm going to do, and go through it without the actual completion, so that they can see the sequence. Because otherwise, when something spontaneous or new occurs, they can become quite frightened. In a moment, I'm going to talk about anxiety. But it's almost demonstrating what's going to occur without any discomfort or pain. Then, okay, I'm going to do it again, but this time I'm going to do this, so that they know the sequence of events.
That's interesting, talking slower, because sometimes some autistic kids can be they can talk quite quickly, and they seem to have a fascination on one topic, and they can talk a lot about one topic and seem quite knowledgeable. But you're saying that going slower when talking to them or explaining or showing them something is important, because they're not going to maybe grasp it as quickly as they might seem they are able to grasp the topic that they've been telling you about, that sort of personal interest topic.
Yeah, what you've got is a problem of processing speed, and also understanding terms and aspects of life that they've not experienced before, with which the medical or nursing staff are very familiar and roll out easily. These are new terms and words for the person, so they're going to take time to process.
Okay. Now, Tony, the fourth point on our list, I'm just having a little trouble reading my handwriting. what was the fourth point that we had written down that I could...
Well, the next one, really, from my point of view, is anxiety.
Anxiety, okay.
And 85% of those with autism have clinical levels of anxiety. That's a lot. Now, the thing is, an accident and emergency situation is new. They are unaware of the conventions, it's new experiences. And there's a degree of uncertainty of where am I, how long am I going to be here for, what's going to happen. So their anxiety is going to go through the roof. So if you've got an attitude towards someone with autism, think of someone with extreme anxiety. And in which case, your voice will be reassuring. You will be able to explain things with a calm, respect, slow and methodical, because once you've alleviated the anxiety, you're more likely to make a connection. But there will be high levels of anxiety.
And are patients on anxiety medications usually for this, or is it generally something that is just brought about by situations such as stressful situations?
Look, I think we have quite often a generalized anxiety disorder, but certain phobias, social anxiety, selective mutism, and every aspect of anxiety is going to be there. And usually there is medication, less so with the younger kids because they're young. And it's usually an SSRI. But be careful, because half of those who have autism, when prescribed an SSRI, have a paradoxical reaction of becoming quite agitated and, in fact, not relaxing at all. So if you are using, in a way, psychotropic medication, be careful, because those with autism are very prone to the side effects. So if you use a benzodiazepine, you're not necessarily going to get somebody relaxed. There's a possibility that they may become hyperactive. So you do need to talk to the parents or caregivers for any history of adverse reactions to a range of medications.
That sort of goes to the next point of meltdown, because I guess one of the aims here was to try and establish an approach that we can avoid creating a meltdown situation, because an autistic meltdown can be very distressing for everybody involved. And you're mentioning benzodiazepines for sedation. You might be tempted, if somebody was having a meltdown, to use sedation in an emergency setting. Can you talk a little bit about the meltdown?
Well, first of all, if you're trying to administer medication when they object, you're going to have a huge amount of resistance and half your staff sitting on the person to try and get the medication administered. It's best not to be in that situation if you can help it. Now, one of the problems of meltdowns is the person has had a sensory and social and anxiety overload, the fuse has blown. But meltdowns can be apparent from early infancy. But what parents have discovered is that distraction, consoling, compassion, all those sorts of things that work with typical kids often don't work in autism. And so what we often have to do is, okay, the hurricane has come in, there's nothing we can do with it, we've got to wait till it moves on. So sometimes it's back off, wait until the level of emotion has naturally drained away or exhausted, and then return. Because there may be a reaction of saying, well, look at this, I'm sorry, distraction won't work. Consoling, compassion, affection, which is very distressing for parents, they find doesn't work either. So once that meltdown occurs, they're really looking for a sanctuary. If we're dealing with somebody at that stage, we may say in a calm, reassuring way, okay, you're really upset. Be a good idea to close your eyes and listen to music. So in other words, that they are not having visual stimuli, which is too much. They cut out the auditory by listening to soothing music, and the person may rock or do some activities that in many ways helps them to calm down naturally.
And one area that we for everybody, actually, it can be quite distressing. Cutting plaster casts off with a plaster saw, we often have ear protection headphones available for use in those situations. But in a meltdown situation, you mentioned music, patients would maybe bring that with them, but if they didn't have that, is something like ear defenders to cut out the noise, does that help?
It helps, but it won't eradicate the problem. This is really quite frightening for the person with autism. So it's something that needs to be managed very, very carefully. But unfortunately, this is a common characteristic because fractures occur because of misadventure. They are often clumsy, poorly coordinated, they climb and do things. They love being on heights and getting to the top of things, and they fall. And when you have to cut off the cast, this is perhaps one of the most traumatic experiences for a person with autism, not only because of what's happening, but also the sensory component. I wish somebody would develop a silent saw, because that's what we need.
Certainly there are some casting materials out there now that are being developed that are they're kind of braces that are all encircling casts, but they've got like you have on ski boots, those tightening things, and then they can be released, so you don't need a cast saw to cut them off. So there are some things coming out, some technological wonders that will make that part of this problem a lot easier for patients, certainly.
I do hope, but it does mean that whatever medical procedure is going to be used, such as a cast, is to remember autism. Think first autism. And is this going to cause a problem for someone else later on? So it's to think wisely.
So it may actually direct your treatment initially, because you're predicting further down the line that we might put this patient in this, but we're going to choose a splint rather than a cast because it's a balance of treating appropriately, but also not having to go down the line of cutting the cast off later. And also, yeah, as you say, highlighting it in the notes so that when the next visit happens, that you're pre-warned. So I guess that's a good point. If a patient has autism, it's worth having it as an alert on the notes so that the next person who's never met them before is
pre-warned. Yes, Guy, can I affirm that? Because that needs to be very conspicuous. Because as you just said, when they come back, the chances are they may return. And if they've had a bad experience once, then there's going to be even more anxiety and resistance and appeasing. Are you all right? Yes, because I just want to get out of here. And if I say yes and do things to please you, then I'm going to go. So we do need to try and make it, should we say, as an autism-friendly environment as we can.
And that's obviously important, because they, as you say, they will be back with injuries or illnesses later on in their life, and we need them to not have that fear of coming back. But can we do them any? Do they come to any other negative harms if we do maybe instigate a meltdown through mismanaging them from the autistic side of things? Are we at danger of worsening them from a psychological point of view?
In the issue of trauma, no, because this happens every day. So it's just another trauma that's going to occur. So I don't think that there will be a guilt of somebody being traumatized for the rest of their life. It's unpleasant, but it's necessary for the person. Now, what some organizations have done, which is worthwhile considering, is there are little booklets on going to hospital. Now, that's usually for surgery and things like that. It's different from accident and emergency. But the parents might be able to find some information out about the situation and what's going to happen. So there are booklets from the National Autistic Society, actually, in the UK. And there are little books for children with autism of going to hospital, what the procedures are, etc. Is another one. So I think the more knowledge the person has, the more they're going to lower their anxiety, the more responsive and positive they're going to be.
And I'll try and put some links in the show notes to some of that literature for people to find. From what you've been saying today, that there's the identifying early and addressing the all of these sort of considerations before they become a problem is important. And it might be reasonable for departments to have some consideration to a particular room, which might be, because we have rooms set aside for isolation of, you know, infectious diseases, and we have rooms for examining eyes and things. So we do have rooms set aside for particular things, but it might be worth looking at developing a room that is autism friendly. And that would be your pointers for that would be sound and light would be the two important variables that we'd need to be able to control. Is that?
Yes, I very much endorse that suggestion. They need a sanctuary, somewhere they can go to calm down. And once they're in a calmer state of mind, they're going to be much more responsive to treatment.
And in that sort of setting, is like a closed door room, does that tend to make them feel supported, or do they tend to prefer to know where the exit is?
Usually it's to try and stop access, and to be, it's usually sort of under the table or under the bed is where they may retreat, because it's a safer environment. So it's really understanding the nature of autism, but also very important, prior to somebody coming in, just the accident emergency team knowing in the hospital who's autism friendly, possibly by having an autistic child. And if in doubt, ask them what to do.
So have the environment right, pre-arrange things, and be mindful of who in your staff has the understanding to maybe be the one to call upon, and try to avoid the meltdown. But as you say, if a meltdown happens, you're better to step away and let things calm down and on their own before trying to actively do anything.
Yeah, because eventually it will go, but there's nothing, and I wish I could find something that could intervene to reduce the intensity and duration. I'm sorry, I haven't found it in 40 years.
But forewarned is forearmed, so I think that's probably a key thing, is think autism and go slow is the other point I would take from what you're saying here, is that don't rush these things, and just and be methodical and be respectful and ask the right questions, and hopefully whilst these, you know, a fractured arm that requires treatment is not a nice thing, it's a necessity, we get on and treat them, but we can do it in a way that is as little distress caused as possible.
Yeah, I think that's the best thing. And
was there anything else?
Think that it really, I think we've covered the main points that I would like to get across.
Excellent. So I'd like to thank you, Professor Atwood, for your time today talking about something that you are very, very knowledgeable about. And whilst autism isn't an emergency or urgent care condition in terms of how we manage the overall condition, we do, with 1 in 60, we're going to come into contact with these patients in the line of our normal work. And so I think what you've told us today is going to help us make the patient journey through our department and the patient's parents and carers, that journey much better, much more pleasurable, and also will enable us to not miss anything by being able to properly assess the patient, so we don't miss any important information. So thank you very much for sharing your expertise. You're currently in New Zealand doing a series of talks. You're going to Palmerston North in the next few days and then up to Auckland, but you're in New Zealand most years doing lectures, so people can see you in person, and they can find your book, The Complete Guide to Asperger's Syndrome, is probably the leading textbook worldwide on that topic, and is certainly worth a read if anybody is interested in learning more on the topic. And you can be found online, and you've certainly got a presence in YouTube and the podcast world, so for people who want to hear more about your teachings on this. So Yes, thank you for sharing your expertise with us today.
Thank you, Guy. My pleasure.
I've said it before, and I'm ready to tell it again. In my lowest moments, I'm my own best friend. I want to connect with the people around me, the people that doubt me. But being in a loud scene with a crowd screaming around me is totally overwhelming, to the point where I feel I'm drowning. The sea and the fear surround me, the cheers are bringing me down deep. But now the crowning glory is how the crowd applaud me. Applause resounding all around, the sound is out of the ordinary. Kinda like my personality, till I learned it wasn't a tragedy. These mannerisms and Danielisms are things that make me actually me. An atom within the matter that's spanning the seas and planets and galaxies. And that isn't an allegory, we're all composed of energy. And it means the planets are colour beans with infinite different varieties. So why are me and V seen as a difficult bit of society? Nah, we're the facets in the diamond. While you're on the mountain shouting, you can't see the fact we're climbing. Me, I'm living with autism, and all the world a stage for which I never auditioned. Me, I'm living with autism, my brain plays a syncopated change of pace to your rhythm. I'm living with autism, and these bars form the sounds of my mental prison. Till I saw a dead that needs to be forgiven for being me. I'm living with autism. Me, I'm living with autism, and all the world a stage for which I never auditioned. Me, I'm living with autism, my brain plays a syncopated change of pace to your rhythm. I'm living with autism, and these bars form the cells of my mental prison. Till I saw I did the need to be forgiven for being me. I'm living with autism.